When Anthony Laddish was just a young guy, 19 years old, bearded and bespectacled, trying to figure out how to become a filmmaker, he lost his dad. It was rough, and so he was going through his dad's old stuff when he stumbled on a box of reel-to-reel tapes. They were letters to his dad in Kansas City from a musician out in California.
After, you know, threading up the first tape that said Riff Charles on it and hitting the play button, the very first thing I heard was literally one of the most melodious voices I've ever heard in my entire life. And this guy says, ladies and gentlemen, for all the Freudian existentialists, for all the Zen Buddhists,
for all the subterraneans of the Beat Generation who, as Lord Buckley so beautifully put it, don't know where they're going, but they know that they gotta go, because they know that where they are isn't it. A fantasy entitled, be it ever so humble, there's no place.
You know, and it goes on, and it blew my mind. I mean, it absolutely just completely obliterated my brain.
Oh, well, I've just found joy.
From a dot in the middle of the map, this is Midwesternish. I'm Gina Kaufman. In this episode, the box full of tapes that changed everything Anthony thought he knew. Not just about his dad, but about the death of Kansas City jazz. To follow this story, you're gonna need a cast of characters. So to start, there's Anthony the filmmaker and his dad, known as the Mop.
My dad was called the Mop because he had this crazy kind of mop of hair.
The musician in California was C.B. Embry. He wrote for Esquire under the name Riff Charles in the 1940s and 50s.
Embry was called the Brush because he had a mustache. He said like Jerry Calhoun, who was a you know, kind of an entertainer.
And then there's this third guy, a minor character for our purposes, known as the Good Doctor.
Ken West was called the Good Doctor. In a letter, he said Ken was called the Good Doctor for reasons unexplained.
They all met during World War II.
Okay, so during the war, they were stationed in Quonset Point, Rhode Island. So they never went overseas, and they were all photographers and graphics technicians. So during the day, they had a hangar that was a graphics laboratory and a photo lab, but by night, they would, you know, Embry would come over to their hangar, and they would. My dad had a machine that you could cut vinyl records, 78s, directly from a microphone, and they would turn it into a recording studio. And they called it the Rational Broadcasting Corporation, you know, broadcasting over station WOLF, the Wolf. And then they would make these skits and play songs, and they would do fake interviews with, you know, pretending that they were famous musicians. And I mean, they were 19, 20-year-old kids.
These guys stayed in touch after the war, but instead of picking up a pen and writing conventional letters, they made recordings.
They would basically have like an old tube Ampex reel-to-reel player and a microphone. And in Embry's case, he was a piano player and a singer. So he would play piano and sing songs and then, you know, just send messages back and forth, you know, to my dad. And then my dad would reciprocate. And my dad was, you know, didn't sing. He played the drums. So my dad was kind of the technical guy. So he would do like little like sound effects gags. Like he would, you know, write a skit and then record it in overdub sound effects and send those back to CB. And, you know, they would kind of go back and forth across the country like that.
So you found one side of the correspondence, I'm guessing?
I did. It kind of, you know, the whole thing kind of goes back, you know, honestly, when I was around 12 or 13 years old, I was just like a skater kid, just like a punk kid, you know. And I remember one day my dad called me down into the basement because he wanted to share with me these tapes. And he was like, oh, I had this friend, you know, during the war, and he was this really cool guy, and you should really hear this. And he starts to try to explain all this stuff to me, and he plays me one of these tapes, and I was like, ah, that's really cool. I'm going to go out and skateboard now. You know, I just didn't care, you know, because you think...
Because you're 12 or 13.
I'm 12 years old. I know, you know, I just want to go skateboarding. You know? You know, you just kind of become a... You know, whatever, you know, I think
stop telling the amazing stories.
Every
right now.
12, stop being so cool. You know, and you know, I think every 12-year-old's a narcissist, really. You know, it's like, I just don't care about anything but myself. So I just was like, oh, that's really cool. I'm gonna go outside now. And then after he passed away, my dad passed away really, you know, he got sick and he passed away really quickly. Like, I was 19 years old. And I vaguely had this remembrance that he had tried to explain all this stuff to me, and I knew that Embry's nickname was Riff. And so, you know, when I found all these tapes, I found a handful of tapes, and it was like Riff and Mandy. And then there was one that said Riff Charles and one that said Riff and Scatman, and, you know, all these tapes. And so those were the ones that I really, you know, centered on when I, you know, when I took this box of tapes out, and it was a world that I didn't know existed. And it was a father, you know, like, I was like, my dad's friend, ipso facto, my dad was this cool too, because they're having this conversation. And I am kind of hearing one side of the conversation, because what they would do, and this is actually sort of technical, but a reel-to-reel tape has a left side and a right side to it. And what they would do is one of them would record on the left side, and then the other one would get it, listen to it in mono, flip the tape over, and record on the left side, effectively the right side, and then send the tape back.
Mom, I'm sure glad to have that tape that Christy sent. You tell him, man. I sure appreciate having it. I'm going to write him a letter about the Kansas City Jazz Workshop concert. Very interesting. Very interesting. That cat, what's his name? Danny Tucker, what is that his name? Sammy Tucker, man, he plays. He plays. Yeah. Wish I played. Well, here's another song, as long as I'm doing some original material for you. I've written another song called The Picture of Dorian Gray. Well, it's like Professor Smith said. He said, I don't know anything about women, but I know what I like. I've got a picture that I hang on the wall, but I took it down when the neighbors call. I put it back up when the neighbors go away. It's a picture of a chick named Dorian Gray.
So, Anthony, tell us about what Dorian we are hearing.
Sorry, I'm kind of getting a little emotional. We're hearing Charles Embry, C.B. Embry, my dad's friend, in his studio apartment in Los Angeles, California, you know, playing what he referred to as ukulele-style piano. And actually, Embry's still alive, and just lovely, beautiful, beautiful man. And I asked him about that, and he said, I said, what do you mean ukulele-style piano? And he said, well, he had a short-scale piano because he lived in a studio apartment, and it only had one string per piano note instead of multiple strings like a normal piano. And I always thought it was like a stylistic thing, but but so he's playing and he's singing these original compositions, and he's just talking to my dad. And this is the thing that, you know, it just made me smile, because I was like, you know, who's Mr. Smith? What's Dorian Gray? And you know, all of a sudden it's you go down this rabbit hole of having to unpack all of these references that were just like these hipster references to these guys that were just like a second nature. It's like, you know, us making, you know, jokes about the movie High Fidelity and, you know, it just being a thing, or, you know, The Big Lebowski, and you just say a line and everybody knows what you're talking about. But for them, they had their own set of, you know, of iconography and their own lingo and their own sort of set of references. And it was really, for me, incredibly comforting and, helped me deal with the passing of my father, to be able to fill my mind with this and to be able to try to spend time unpacking all of this information.
Discovering this underground hipster version of his dad.
I don't even know if I can describe it. It, you know, once again, it just kind of was a mind-blowing experience to think, like, my dad had a life before he was married, before he had me, way before he had me. And not only that, but it was literally like one of the coolest things I've ever seen in my entire life. And it was transformative for me, because it just went to show me what it did for me, because I'm an artist, I'm a musician, I'm a filmmaker. I'm never fitting into square society. I'm just not ever going to be able to sit behind a desk and do something normal for a living. It's never happening. And I didn't know that then, because I was young and dumb and I just had no idea. I was scared to death because I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. But the one thing that I did know was that I was never going to not tell stories, and I was never going to not try to do something creative, no matter how good it is or not. What that did for me was it showed me that I can make movies and be respected at that, and I can make music and I can be equally respected at that, and I can tell any kind of story, any kind of way, and all of those things can inform each one of those things can inform the other thing. And, it's like I come from a long line of Renaissance people, you know?
Yeah, you found a role model.
These guys were the best role models ever. That's what it was. It absolutely transformed me into the person that I am today.
Anthony made a movie out of one of the tapes. The movie's called Be It Ever So Humble, There Is No Place. It's basically a silent movie about Kansas City jazz back in the day. And it's narrated entirely by C.B. Embry, The Brush, reading a piece he wrote for Esquire on one of those reel-to-reel tapes.
Sitting in a chrome and leather tomb the other night, square in the middle of that giant graveyard they call Kansas City, I was inhaling some pre-war helium and praying for a quick ascent when one of the local ghosts faded in, drifted across the floor, sat down at the bar, just climbed right up on a stool there and sat down beside me. I looked around. The way this zombie started lapping up that embalming fluid, I knew for sure he'd been dead a long time. But I was beginning to feel alive enough for both of us, so I started a conversation. Things are sure quiet around here, I said. Not like the old KC I used to know. The body didn't say anything for a long minute. Finally, staring into the blue mirror in front of him, he breathed, "Paradise Lost." Paradise Lost? For a moment, I let myself think about how it used to be when KC was a big neon beacon for all fly riders.
You know, Kansas City had a heyday of big bands. We had big bands, 20 people in a band, and the war took away all those musicians. So what made Kansas City jazz, these big head arrangements and these kind of riffs and this big, giant, powerful swing sound. And when the war happened, as I was saying, all of those musicians that filled those huge bands, they all went into the service, into the Navy band. And at that point, then all you're left with is like a piano player, a drummer, a couple of horn players.
You know, a little bit of audience, maybe?
A small band. So the war killed Kansas City jazz. And then bebop rose up during that time period, during the war era. And after the war era, post-war, then because bebop was really passionate, it was like, let's jam all the passion of these 20 musicians into these five guys. And then after that, so in the 50s, you start coming up with Chet Baker and you start coming up with, Miles Davis and these guys, cool jazz. And cool jazz, while I enjoy it, it's so detached and it's exactly that. It's cool. It's cold. The whole point of it is to be kind of unaffected by everything. And so in 1953, Embry, who is a child of this big band sound and this amazing, he comes from, Benny Goodman and Jack Teagarden and Big Spiderbeck and these cornet players, and Louis Armstrong was his hero. And to come from that sound and then in 1953 be kind of, inundated with, thank you for asking these questions. I've never really thought about it like this. I think Be It Ever So Humble, There's No Place is an absolute indictment of cool jazz. That's to me.
Yeah, sure is quiet.
It sure is quiet around here. Well, oh my God, I just got goosebumps. That's incredible. Thank you. Yeah, that's, yeah.
Well, no, thank you. I mean, what kind of intrigues me about all of this, though, is that the story for you isn't just the city's history and how it gets told. It's personal. It's about understanding your own father. And if you don't mind me saying so, to have lost him at age 19, at that age, you're not quite done having a father. I mean, you just are not. And And it seems to me that you're continuing to have an artistic dialogue and correspondence and in a way, keeping that relationship around as long as you need it.
I never got to buy my dad a drink. I never got to sit down and ask him, you know, all these questions. And I remember after he had passed away and I was doing the work that would become, you know, without sounding, you know, hyperbolic, my life's work, I had a dream in which I had a conversation with my dad, and it was really odd because I walked into my parents' house and he was sitting at the kitchen table where he normally sat, and I said, "Oh my God, I can't, you're back." And he said, "Well, yeah, I'm back for a little bit." And he said, and I said, "There's so many things I want to ask you. What was Kansas City like in the 30s? What, you know, and like going through all this stuff." He said, "There's going to be plenty of time for us to talk about that." And he said, "I just need you to know I'm really proud of you." And I woke up just in total sobbing tears.
Oh my gosh. Well, I want to play one last little bit of tape. It's the sound of the brush signing off at the end of the track you used for Be It Ever So Humble, There Is No Place. Let's give it a listen.
I was all alone in the joint. Not a soul in the place but me and the bartender, and him leaping over the bar at me with a sawed-off pool cue in one hand. What was it that cat Thomas Wolfe said? You can't go home again? Mop.
This episode of Midwesternish was produced by Matt Hodapp and Matthew Long Middleton. Sylvia Maria Gross is our editor. You can subscribe to this podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you generally do that kind of thing. The stories come from a daily talk show on Kansas City's public radio station, KCUR 89.3. The show is called Central Standard, so just head over to kcur.org if you want to check it out. I'm Gina Kaufman.